Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the Seymour Centre at the 2018 Festival.
Hello and welcome to Sydney Writers Festival 2018. My name is Jamila Risby and I'm delighted to welcome you all here today. This session is titled Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong with Angela Saini. So if you were looking for Inferior, How the Labor Party Got Mark Latham Right, you are in the wrong room and we do not want you here. Now, Angela Saini is a British writer and science journalist who presents science programs on BBC Radio 4 and the World Service. She has a Master's in Engineering from Oxford University and a second Master's in Science and Security from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Her parents are waiting for her to do something for which they can be proud. We're going to be discussing her second book, Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong, and the new research that's rewriting history. I know that there will be some people in the room who are science nerds. Welcome. You are not my people. For those of you who are sitting here going, oh, I'm a bit anxious, I wanted to hear her speak, but science is not my thing. I finished science in year 10 after a science teacher told me that I struggled to understand basic concepts. So I promise that this is not going to be above anyone's head. We are going to struggle through this together. Now, sex differences are still one of the most contentious topics in scientific research, and some of that research reinforces what we call the myth that the gaps between men and women are huge, that women are more empathetic, that men are better at spatial reasoning, that they want more sex than women do, and so forth. Today we're going to talk to Angela about some of the science behind what we read in the news, some of the science behind the things that we just have inside our heads, the assumptions that we make. We're going to get to the crux of the discussion in just a few seconds, but I just wanted to note that before we have this discussion, there are many people for whom their biological sex and their gender are not the same. Please know that for the purposes of this discussion, we will endeavour as much as we can to use the terms female and male when we're speaking about biological sex only, and we'll use men and women when we're speaking about gender, and we very much mean to do so as inclusively as possible. Okay. Let's get to the Angela bit. Stop me talking. Angela, historically, women have been consistently excluded from the sort of scientific community, whether it's Marie Curie being rejected from the Academy of Sciences in France the year that she won her second Nobel Prize, or the appalling lack of women in STEM even today. What do you think that's meant for the evolution of science as a discipline, not having women there?
I think we forget how when modern science was created, at its very birth, and I mean by this Enlightenment science, so European Enlightenment science, at that inception, women were deliberately excluded. It was a mission to liberate people, the Enlightenment. You know, it was about freedom, but not freedom for women. And even Rousseau didn't include women in this Enlightenment project. So from those very early days, it was assumed that women didn't have the intellectual capacity to do science, that this was something just for men. And that got embedded within modern science from a very early stage. So by the time you get to Darwin in the mid-1800s, it was no surprise that he looked at the world around him, he saw that women weren't achieving as much as men, and he said, women are intellectually inferior. And he wrote that. In fact, the title of the book comes from exactly that, from Darwin. And he assumed that they had evolved that way. And why wouldn't he think that when, for hundreds of years, everybody around him had told him that? So this kind of ingrained idea that women are incapable of doing science, that there's something biologically, intellectually different about them, that they don't have the same psychological capacities as men, survived for a very long time. And we forget, actually, how recently that changed. So even beyond the Marie Curie example, the Royal Society in the UK, which is one of the world's oldest scientific academies and one of the most important, didn't admit women until 1945, which is the year my dad was born. So that's within living memory. Mm. And even when they did admit women, a lot of these academies and societies did so very reluctantly. I mean, the Royal Society of Chemistry only admitted women when a woman sat the exam under a pseudonym, under a man's name, and then when she passed, they had to admit her, and that was how she got in. So this kind of legacy of exclusion has been around for a very long time, but the exclusion itself was a product of the assumption that women were intellectually inferior. So in both ways, in both senses, it was embedded there, and to some extent, and this is the argument I make, it's still embedded within science.
How did that affect you growing up as a kid? I imagine you had some interest in science. Yeah. Did it hold you? Did you think it turned you away a little bit? Were there teachers that sort of suggested this wasn't a discipline for you? Or did you feel quite free in making the choices that you did?
No, I felt quite free. And I think that's the experience of a lot of schoolgirls, that at the school level, actually, you're very rarely discouraged from studying science. I mean, there are exceptions. There are women I've met whose teachers have kind of undermined their choices. But that certainly didn't happen to me. I grew up in a very egalitarian family. My dad had been an engineer. I loved making things. I loved building things. You know, it seemed very natural to me to follow this as an interest because why not? Nobody ever told me I couldn't do it. It actually took a very long time after I left university to start to realize just how flawed this system was. It was really, as a science journalist, going out there, meeting people, understanding how it was that actually research works, the kind of systematic sexism and harassment that women were experiencing in many lab environments, which only now is coming to light through the Me Too movements. So there's been the very high-profile case of Inda Verma, which has just happened, very high-profile scientist who has been outed as a sexual harasser, sexual abuser. Lawrence Krauss very recently, that just happened. There's going to be a lot more stories like that. Science is very much like a Hollywood casting couch. These are women, often young women, working in environments where there's an older man who has complete power over their careers. And they do abuse that. Men do abuse that. And it's very difficult for them to speak out because their careers hinge on it. You know, their lives could be destroyed if they say anything. So they either put up with it or they leave. And many do leave, which is, again, why you see fewer women in the pipeline higher up.
I think we often think about science as sort of the bastion of fact, the holder of truth. You know, often we see in the media, for example, science says, and that's the end of the argument because science says it. Yeah. But you explain in the book that the sexism you're talking about there that women experience in the lab or in studying also makes its way into the work and into the results.
Yeah, well, this is really what the book is about. So I'm not looking at women in science, although I think that issue is central to why science says the things it does. What I'm asking is, what does research actually say about us? And that's the question I wanted to get to the heart of. As a woman, I want to know, what actually does science say about my body and my mind? Because the message I get from the journals and from the press is so mixed. I've read headlines in newspapers telling me that women are rubbish at parking, that women are better at multitasking, men are rubbish at communicating. You know, constantly we're fed these kind of these studies that seem to either confirm our stereotypes or ditch our stereotypes. Now, which one am I supposed to believe? That's what I wanted to get to the heart of. What do the scientists actually say? And as it turns out, the reason that they're so contradictory is because science itself is a battleground when it comes to women's minds and bodies. They can't agree between themselves. We are so complex as a species. We live in so many different ways, in so many different cultures. Over time, we change our behaviour. You know, so women in the 70s behave different from the women now. So if you were to do a study of, say, sexual behaviour of women in the 70s, it's not going to look the same as a study of sexual behaviour of women now. So that's how the science becomes misleading when we're trying to understand who we actually are.
Well, let's get into some of that. Let's get into some of that science. We might start with talking a little bit about evolution. You touched on Charles Darwin earlier. He quite literally thought that women were less evolved than men. Is that right?
Yes. So there is some logic to this. So if you he used the example of the peacock. So if you look at the peacock, it has these big, beautiful feathers. The peahen, by comparison, is very plain-looking. She doesn't have these big feathers. And the reason for this, he explained, and this does hold true for the peacock, is that the peacock has to attract the female. He has to work extra hard because she has the baby-making equipment, and if he wants to reproduce, he has to attract her. And so that's why he evolved this kind of cumbersome machinery to kind of get the female. And he extended that to humans. His logic was that human males are more creative, more intelligent, more impressive in every respect because they have evolved to be that way in order to attract females. And us females are, in comparison, kind of drab and chaste and passive and not so intelligent.
I don't like Charles Darwin anymore.
Do you know, the odd thing is, Darwin was so careful in his science. He was painstaking. And I visited his house recently. His house, Down House in Kent, is still there. You can visit it. It's a museum. And you can see, you know, specimens and his work laid out. He was so careful and painstaking about the theory of evolution. It took him a really long time to decide to write it down and collate it and explain everything. When it came to women, he literally just looked around at Victorian society, saw that women weren't achieving as much, and just assumed that must be a reflect a biological fact, that this was somehow rooted in nature, which is incredibly lazy and very unlike Darwin, actually.
But you argue that despite what Darwin wrote, some of his theories actually offered great promise to the women's movement at the time.
Well, just imagine, this was the 1800s, and a lot of women, especially in Europe and the US, lived under the yoke of religious ideas of a woman's place. So, you know, that they were designed to be mothers and their place was in the home. Now, evolutionary theory, when it came along, revolutionized that. It was, it threw all of that out of the water. If we were evolved from, you know, simpler creatures, just like every other species, then why should those rules hold true anymore? Mm. You know, for the women's movement, it was actually a gift. But of course, Darwin wasn't saying that, and other male Victorian biologists weren't saying that. They were saying, yes, we have this evolutionary theory, but we still believe there's a woman's place, and we believe there's a woman's place now. So in some sense, the sexism just became more entrenched. It got reframed by evolutionary theory in a new way. And then that, in this kind of, with layers and layers of new science, just got pushed further and further as a justification for why women didn't deserve the vote, for instance. I mean, in 1912, I think it was, Walter Heap, who was one of the leading reproductive biologists in the world at the time, wrote an entire book, and I've read the entire book, arguing that women out campaigning for the vote, and women in the UK, or some women in the UK, gained the vote in 1918, so this is just before they gained the vote, he argued that they were wasting their reproductive energy by going out and campaigning, that actually they'd be better off. They were actually, you know, losing the ability to be fertile by going out and campaigning. And he wrote an entire book on that. So this wasn't some innocent enterprise. He was actually undermining the women's fight for equality. He was telling women outright, what you are doing is damaging your families, damaging your health, and just give up. That was a political act. You know, he wasn't saying you're damaging your reproductive energy by washing the clothes or looking after your children. You're damaging your reproductive energy by fighting for the vote. So we have to remember, this wasn't an apolitical thing that was happening. This was very intimately tied up with the politics of the time. And there were many men within the sciences who didn't want things to change, who wanted the status quo to remain as it was, and used their science to make that argument. Mm.
And despite the work of all these powerful men, there were women both within the women's suffrage movement and women who were interested in science who pushed back against these theories. And you tell one story in the book that really touched me about a woman who didn't have scientific training but wrote to Darwin telling him she thought he was wrong.
Yeah. There were many women, actually, in Victorian times who wrote to Darwin and challenged him, and he corresponded with many of them. There was one in particular called Eliza Burt Gamble, who was a schoolteacher in Michigan, and she'd lost her parents when she was very young. She educated herself, became a very accomplished teacher. She didn't have access to higher education, but she read Darwin's books, and she read the evidence very differently from him. She read it as saying that women were superior. And so she went to the Library of Congress, she educated herself on the biology in general, but also the history and the culture, and you know, the you know, how women came to be in the subordinate position that they were in now. And she wrote a book about women's superiority to man, an entire challenge to what other people were writing. And she was very popular in her time. Her books, you know, sold, they went into subsequent reprints. But for the scientific establishment, they just didn't listen. You know, it really had very little impact on them whatsoever. It was with ordinary people that she made some inroads, but science didn't change because of her.
Moving forward to more modern understanding of evolution, why have scientists come to understand that women, human women, live longer than men? And, you know, on average, I think it's almost a decade longer than the blokes. We're doing very well.
Yeah. I think it's important to say, I mean, often the debate, this was a challenge I had when writing this book. So a lot of books on gender and sex difference fall into two camps. They're either men are from Mars, women are from Venus, or they're we're the same. You know, there are no differences between us. And actually, the truth doesn't lie at either of those extremes. There are, of course, differences between us, the obvious reproductive differences, height, upper body strength, these are average differences between men and women, but also life expectancy. And this is one difference, actually, that for some reason hasn't been investigated very much. Why do women live longer than men? We know that it's been true for as long as we've kept records, and it's been true all over the world, that women have this slight edge. Also, what we do know is at birth, and if you speak to a midwife or a doctor in a maternity hospital, they will tell you, on a ward where you have premature babies or you have sick babies, the girls are more likely to survive than the boys. What we know now, science is telling us, is that survival edge that a newborn baby has, a baby girl, stays with her entire life. Women have stronger immune systems, more flexible, so we recover from you know, coughs and colds, small illnesses more quickly. So this man flu thing is actually probably
a bit
real. There's
truth to it.
There's some truth to it. You know, there is this theory now also that when you look at all the major causes of death, women seem to survive them when they kill men. Now, one of the side effects of this, of course, is that women live with pain more. So one of the things that doctors often say is that men die quicker, but women are sicker. Because there are surviving things that kill the men. So we live with that pain. We live with the pain of having given birth, and that can often lead to long-term pain throughout your life. Mm. There's also autoimmune disease. Women are more likely to suffer from autoimmune diseases for genetic reasons. And there are things like arthritis. So again, that causes pain. So there's a trade-off here. We do live longer. We do have this survival edge. There's one scientist who described it to me as being more robust. We are more robust. Why has this not been investigated? It's only now that researchers are looking at it, and some of them are looking at it as the key to longevity, trying to understand what is it that makes women so strong. Is there some secret there in our genes, in our bodies, in our hormones somewhere?
And it's interesting that you say that scientists are starting to focus on that difference now, because when it comes to medical trials, it wasn't until sort of, I think you say in the book, the 1990s, that before that, most medical trials were conducted on male test subjects and not female test subjects. Why was that?
Well, there's a good reason for that, and partly it's because you don't want to give an experimental drug to a woman who might be pregnant. It can have repercussions, obviously, for her unborn child. So for that reason, women of reproductive age were often taken off the table. Mm. That's a really good reason. You know, it makes sense. But at the same time, the side effect of that was, and you'll know if you've been pregnant, there's very few drugs you can take if you're feeling ill or if you're sick or if you suffer pain, because drugs have not been tested on pregnant women. The other side effect has been because males have been the default in clinical trials and clinical testing. The FDA, so this is in America, the Federal Drug Administration, did find that there's a very small number of drugs. So this isn't a kind of widespread problem. You know, just a handful of drugs, five or six drugs, that had more adverse side effects in women than in men. So they were taken off the market. That kind of thing led to a very big campaign. It was going for decades, actually, to get women included in clinical trials, and they won. In the US now, women have to be included in clinical trials. In the EU, they also have a similar law like this. So things have changed because of pressure. But again, I don't, you know, you don't want to conflate this idea into something bigger than it is. Yes, there are differences. Often those differences are just to do with size. You know, a woman tends to be smaller. So of course, a dosage, a particular dosage may affect her differently. It may be hormonal. So it's not necessarily because she's a woman. You know, the drug may have the same effects on a smaller man, for instance.
You talked about women's bodies being smaller just then. Women's brains are also, on average, physically smaller than a man's brain. What are the key differences between a female and a male brain beyond just the size question?
Arguably none. But this is a question that has plagued scientists for hundreds of years. In fact, 100 years ago, there was a woman called Helen Hamilton Gardner in New York, and all the big neurologists at the time were saying that women were more stupid because their brains were smaller. And they'd figured out that that size difference between the average male and the average female brain was 5 ounces, which is right, actually. That is the average difference. And she was just incensed by this. She went to study with a neuroscientist to learn about the brain, dissect them, really get to grips with it. She wrote to loads of experts, and she wrote this wonderful article in Popular Science saying, if absolute brain size were an indicator of intelligence, then humans would not be the most intelligent species. Mm. That would be the whale, or, you know, a far bigger species than us. It's all relative to body size. And if women are on average a little bit smaller, then their brains are obviously going to be a little bit lighter. And, you know, these neurologists got so angry and they, you know, complained in the press, and one of them challenged her to prove that a woman of, you know, a smaller brain size could be as intelligent as a man. And, of course, that's a ridiculous thing because you can only measure, weigh a brain once you're dead. You know, it's very difficult to do it otherwise. So, anyway, she left her brain to science. She left it to a brain lab at Cornell University, and they weighed her brain after she died, and it was bang on average 5 ounces smaller than the average male brain. You know, it was a prototypical brain. It was also exactly the same weight as the very eminent neurologist who founded that brain lab. So posthumously, she proved her point. And of course, now we know that for a fact. But she, with, you know, no formal education, just kind of her own wit and her own her own average-sized brain, proved that, you know? The neurologist didn't listen to her.
Now, there are a whole lot of studies that discuss and cite where monkeys and human babies are given traditional girls' toys and traditional boys' toys, and the girls are more likely to play with the doll, and the boys are more likely to play with the truck. I just don't want to agree with that. Like, you know, when I read that sort of thing, I think, no. And I've got a little boy and I'm constantly shoving dolls in his face and trying to, and being like, care for the doll. And he gets the doll and goes, brum, 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 brum. Why? Why does he do that?
The thing is, play behaviour in children is one of the, you know, big frontiers in sex difference research, because really that's all we can do with little children. What else can you do except observe them playing? And what scientists do see is that from the age of 2 onwards, there are some differences in play behaviour. Whether they are biological or not is really up for question. You know, where do they come from? We don't see those differences before the age of 2. So the question is, what up until the age of 2 can account for that? Now, I have a 4-year-old. And I know that when he watches Peppa Pig, he gets a certain view of the world, and it is a very gendered view of the world. When he goes to school, he gets a very gendered view of the world. I'll just give you an example. So he loves cars and trucks, much like your son. He also recently developed a love of the colour pink. He really loves it. And I went to his parents' evening, and they had lots of hats for sale. And I said, Ren, you pick anyone you want and we'll pay for it. He picked the pink one. And when he went to pay for it, the lady at the counter said, are you sure that's the hat you want? Is that really the one you want? Wouldn't you rather have the purple one or the blue one? That tiny undermining of a child's choices, even if you grow up in a very gender-neutral household, which, I mean, to my shame, I didn't give him a doll until he was about 3 years old, an Elsa Frozen doll. But, you know, kids, where, if you look at the gifts a child gets given, the toys a child gets given, there will be differences there. When you go to the toy shop, there's a pink aisle and a blue aisle. It's very difficult to go down the aisle that you're not supposed to go down. It's much easier for girls now to go to the blue aisle because, you know, there's, we have this kind of campaign for female empowerment. We want girls to do what boys do. With boys, it's very difficult to go down the pink aisle and say, yes, you can have that pink sparkly thing that you want. So, you know, there's a lot of tiny cues, hundreds, if not thousands of them, from birth until 2 years old. Even at birth, you go to a maternity hospital, there will be pink and blue balloons. How we dress them, everything, how we handle them. There is evidence that shows that boys are handled differently from girls, babies. There is no difference between a boy and a girl baby. You know, they are exactly the same in pretty much every respect, but we handle them differently. So there is a lot to account for that 0 to 2 gap. And that is, you know, much of the where much of the focus is at the moment when it comes to scientific research, understanding that impact up until the age of 2 and what we can do to kind of remove some of these damaging stereotypes. And I say they're damaging, not because I think a gendered society is bad for us. In some ways, it may be good for us to live in a partly gendered society, but I think they're limiting. You know, my boy's choices were being undermined by that woman who said that she, maybe he shouldn't have the pink hat. How unfair is that? That's just as damaging as saying to a girl, you can't be a scientist because this is something that boys do.
And I think as parents, we often try and eliminate, like I know I try very hard to eliminate those gender biases, but you can't. You can't. It's a gendered world. It's impossible
not to. And in some way, you want them to conform because it makes it easier for them. You don't want to be the mum of the kid, of the boy who wears a pink hat at school, because you feel he might get picked on. So in some ways, you kind of steer them away from, you know, what they might want to make life easier for them in a gendered world.
It very much goes to the idea, I think, that a lot of us have in our heads still, that nature versus nurture question. But scientists have recently come to understand that clearly it's not nature or nurture, it's both, but also that the two are somewhat interdependent. Is that right? That the brain continues to evolve.
Yes, absolutely. It's very plastic. And this is something we've only really got to grips with in the last 20, 30 years, is that the brain is changing throughout life. And the big research that really made that clear was done in London by a female scientist, a female neuroscientist. She was looking at the brains of black cab drivers. So in London, to drive an official black cab, you have to pass the knowledge, which is this very difficult test where you memorize the entire map of London and how to get anywhere as quickly as possible. And London is a maze. You know, it's an incredibly old city. Nothing, it's not a grid like New York, you know, which is all numbered. It is incredibly difficult to pass that test. And she found that the memory centers of the brains of black cab drivers was bigger because they had exercised it. You know, they had to use it. It wasn't that they were born that way. They'd exercised this muscle in the process of trying to learn all these street names and keep them in their heads all the time. And since then, research has been done into lots of people with certain skills, like musicians and jugglers and things like that, and their brains are also different. The brain changes as we get older. There's a theory now that to explain sometimes, so there are some studies that seem to show that women have slightly, on average, and again, this is always on average, and sometimes the statistical significance of these studies is quite tiny, but there is some significance there, you know, that there's different regions of the brain that are different for men and women, or, you know, they map out differently. And there's a theory now that just the experience of being a woman may be affecting your brain's development, and the experience of being a man may be affecting your brain's development in another way. And that, along with the many other experiences we have in life, so, you know, the experience of being a minority or, you know, having a certain job or anything, is shaping your brain in a different way. And what it seems to me is that science is moving away from kind of putting people in buckets two buckets, male or female, and moving towards the idea that we are all actually unique. We share traits. You know, I love the Wendy Williams show in the US, which is a talk show, which a lot of women love. I also love science fiction, which is a trait we usually, you know, an interest we usually associate with men. I'm a complex mix of lots of different interests, and we are all like that, men and women. Men will have lots of interests we think of as traditionally female, and women will have lots of interests that we think of as traditionally male. We are a mosaic, and our brains reflect that. So the healthy and I think progressive thing that's happening in science is that we're starting to see each person as an individual, not just a product of their biology, but also of their experience.
I think that for me, I don't think gender differences and expectations ever had such a role in my life as when I first had a child, and the way that my male partner and I shared parenting, there was suddenly a whole raft of expectations about who should do what. But you write in the book that in hunter-gatherer societies, they were actually much more egalitarian in the way that they shared work between men and women than perhaps we are now.
This was one of the revelations for me. My son was around 2 years old when I was writing this book, and it was acutely, you know, something I was thinking about all the time. Motherhood. What does motherhood actually, how does it play out, this myth of how we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to act? We forget just how common it is for women to neglect their children, in history, to kill their children, behave very badly towards their children. Now, if, you know, motherhood was kind of some natural thing that every woman was endowed with by biology, then how could that possibly happen? And the answer is that the reality of motherhood throughout history has been a strategic one. If she can't cope, if she doesn't have the support she needs, a woman is more likely to neglect and kill her child. That's a fact. And we see it in other species too. Other species do that too. You know, the runt of the litter might get killed off if the mother knows she can't look after it. There is a dynamic that plays out in motherhood that we choose to ignore because we've reified the whole idea of motherhood. We think of it as, we demand perfection of women, that you've had this baby now, you are Mary, and you have to be perfect, and you have to fulfill this role. Well, actually, that's not how things have ever been, or how they are now. Mm-hmm. The women who neglect their children, while that is obviously a terrible thing to do, it's not necessarily unnatural thing to do. If your own needs are not being met as a mother, then how are you supposed to care for somebody else? How are you supposed to give all that love and care and attention to another human being? And I think part of, if you look at hunter-gatherer societies, so the reason hunter-gatherer societies are important for understanding who we are, although I think who we are is also wrapped up in the cultures where we are now, but you know, if you do want to imagine who we are, who we were for the bulk of human history, hunter-gatherer is a kind of a window on that. Not a great window, but a window. And they tend to live in, you know, big communal societies where everybody takes on the responsibility of caring for children. It really does take a village to raise a child. Women always work, of course, you have to, because subsistence living demands it. And the way they do that is by everybody playing a role in taking care of the children. Mm. And that, you know, has played out in my own life. I see women in kind of nuclear families living far away from their grandparents and their parents without any help, and they're expected to cope without any help whatsoever. That is not how we have ever lived. To have a woman on her own with a child every single day and expecting that to be some kind of natural state because she is a mother, that is not how we have ever lived. I am very lucky that I have had my parents and my husband's parents around, aunts, uncles, you know, a community of people, my neighbours, my friends, all around me, and I expect them to be involved in taking care of my son. They are involved. I travel a lot, and they're always involved. Writing that chapter took away a lot of the guilt I felt about going back to work, because it's not just my job to take care of my baby. It's everybody's job to take care of him. And I think we forget that sometimes, especially in a modern age where we kind of put all the weight, the burden of motherhood just on the mother. Parenthood is for all of us.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about the Himba women who seem to hold very different ideas about love and sex and compared to other human societies?
Well, I think understanding female sexuality really gets to the heart of this question of sex difference. Because if we go back to Darwin, so Darwin was saying that the reason that the peacock and the peahen are so different is because of sexual behaviour. The peacock is trying to attract as many females as possible, and the female is kind of sitting back and waiting for the perfect father. And when that was extended to humans, not just by Darwin, but especially in the 1970s. So in the 1970s, the sexual selection theory became very popular. And some of the leading evolutionary biologists were doing work on this. People like Robert Trivers, Don Simons, still kind of seminal thinkers within evolutionary biology. And their idea was that it was all about parental investment. A woman has a finite number of eggs, and she puts in a lot of effort when she gets pregnant because she has to be pregnant for 9 months, and then she has to lactate and take care of this child. So it's in her interest to be monogamous, to wait for the perfect, one perfect father. And on the other hand, men have loads of sperm and very little parental investment, so it's in their interest to be as promiscuous as possible. Mm. And this explains human sexual behaviour, and via sexual selection theory, all the sex differences that we see between us. And in fact, this was so popular that in the 1970s Playboy magazine, and I don't know how many of you read Playboy, but it does carry some heavyweight features now and again. They ran a feature on this research in an issue on secrecy secretaries, and the headline was, "Do men need to cheat on their women, a new science says yes." Because that's what the science was saying. It was essentially saying that men are being, men are kind of denying their natural state by being married, and it was in their, it was a primal urge to want to cheat because that was kind of built into them. Now, at the same time that they were doing this, there was another evolutionary biologist working alongside them, Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy in California. And she came from a very patriarchal Texan oil family. She'd had to run away from home to get married to the man of her choice because her father wanted her to get married to somebody else. And she was very skeptical about all this. It didn't chime with her experiences of sex in the real world. And she thought very carefully about this. She did a lot of work. She was a primatologist, so she studied apes and monkeys first, and then she, looked at humans, but not just kind of basic human behavior. She looked at history. She went far back into time. What does history and culture have to tell us about female sexual behavior? And she made some amazing insights. And the main one was, just think about this, female genital mutilation. Now, for those of you who don't know what FGM is, it is a procedure that is carried out on millions of girls. It has been for thousands of years. There are many women today, millions of women, like I said, who have had this procedure done to them. It essentially involves cutting and then sewing you up. Often, it's incredibly brutal. I interviewed a woman who'd had this procedure done who is now an anti-FGM campaigner. And she still has flashbacks to when she was 6 years old, when it was done to her, of her torn flesh lying on the floor. I mean, it is the most vicious and brutal way of ensuring a woman's virginity before she gets married. Often, women need to be cut open before they can have sex, so after they get married, they need to be cut open again before they can have children. It is the most obvious and brutal form of female sexual oppression in the world. But we have lots of forms of female sexual repression. This is just, on the extreme end. But, there is arguably veiling. In Saudi Arabia, the control of a woman's sexuality is done through by policing her behavior. In Iran, there are protests happening now, White Wednesday protests, because women are being patrolled by morality police, being told they can't dance, they can't wear certain things, they have to behave in a certain way. There are, in history, chastity belts. moral double standard, that exists everywhere. This idea that women should behave differently. You know, that you know, to be promiscuous is to be a slut, but it's okay for a man. So we have myriad forms of female sexual oppression all over the world, encoded in, for a long time, in laws, encoded in religions, in everyday cultures, everywhere. And Sarah Blaffer Hurdy made the very astute observation that if women are naturally monogamous, why do we do this? Why do we go to such brutal and elaborate lengths to control female sexual behaviour if we're naturally monogamous? Mm. We don't need to. That insight overturned what we now think about female sexuality. She really opened a door. And so much work has been done then to challenge these kind of old male orthodoxies about who women are. And there's research being done now. I mean, I was just in Sweden the other week. There's research being done now into female sexual behavior in other species. So, for example, we often assume many bird species to be monogamous. Researchers are learning that many of the females in these so-called monogamous pairs are going out and having affairs with other birds. In the 1970s, there was an evolutionary biologist called Patricia Gowerty who found the same thing in bluebirds. She spent years studying bluebirds, and she noticed that the females were doing this, that they were going away and having these affairs with other male bluebirds. And she came back and she told her male colleagues, and they said to her, they must have been raped. Because that would be the only thing that would explain that kind of aberrant behavior. So the truth is that female sexual behavior is actually far more complicated than we think. It's heavily influenced by society and culture. It has been for thousands of years. Obviously, we've had patriarchy for thousands of years, so of course it has been. Now, coming back to your question, I'm sorry, it's a very roundabout way of coming back to it.
No, it's fascinating. It's like bluebirds' days of our lives.
But the Himba. So the Himba are a tribe in Tanzania who don't follow the same sexual rules as many other societies. And anthropologists have learned this. You know, they've gone out into the world and they've seen that actually human cultures are very different around the world. This is a hunter-gatherer tribe. And it's very... what the researcher learned when she went there, when she lived with them, was that it's perfectly fine for you to have affairs. So there's still marriage, but men and women are allowed to have affairs, and they do, very happily. And in fact, when she was living with them, they said to her, why are you not having an affair? Why don't you just go to that man's tent tonight? And she was like, no, I'm married. And they were like, well, he's not here. He's not good to know. You know, they really don't have the same moral codes. And that's not because they are immoral. It's just because this, you know, the kind of rules that we have grown up with, the codes that we have drawn up for ourselves are really just man-made, you know. There's no reason why we should have to have these rules and not another set of rules. And there are societies that live by other sets of rules.
I'm going to ask you one more question about my favourite part of the book before we open up to the audience for some questions. So if you do have a question for Angela, we'll be with you in just a moment. And we will be instituting my rule, which is that a woman asks the first question, because in every session about feminism, a man asks the first question. And I'm just... anyway. I want you to tell me about the grandmother theory versus the other theory that I don't like as much.
Okay.
I'm not very scientific and unbiased.
So this is how I came to write the book in the first place. So like I said, I have an engineering background, and for most of my career I've done engineering stories, you know, physical sciences. I didn't really look at human behaviour or biology. But when I went back to work after I had my son, The Observer, which is a Sunday paper in the UK, asked me to do a story on the menopause. I don't know why, but they did. It's not something I have direct experience of yet. But... it just so happened that at that time they asked me, a paper had just been published by three male scientists at McMaster University in Canada. And they said that the reason that the evolutionary reason why women experience menopause is because throughout our history, on average, older men have not found older women attractive. And so they don't need to be fertile.
This is the other theory. Yeah.
So this is an extension of a theory that already existed called the patriarch hypothesis, that a small number of older men are essentially having lots of sex with young women, that older women are basically off the table, they're of no use. And this explains the menopause in women. Now, at the very same time, for a long time, there's been a really well-evidenced, well-researched, prevailing theory for why the menopause happens. Now, we have to remember, the menopause itself is not unusual, even though we are one of few species that experience it. You know, killer whales are one. There's very no other primates experience menopause. But the reason is they die around the same time that they become infertile. So if they lived long enough, then they would too. The difference for us is we live so long into our infertile years and very long, healthy lives, you know? Very long, healthy lives. And that is the mystery. Why do we live so long after we lose our fertility? Because by the kind of hard, very tough rules of nature, that shouldn't happen. And the grandmother hypothesis, which is the prevailing hypothesis, argues that the reason is that grandmothers have been so crucial to the survival of their families. So we have a good mechanism here. The presence of a grandmother makes it more likely that her children and grandchildren will survive. And we see this statistically. Studies have been done to show that the presence of a grandmother really does guarantee, does increase the survival rates of children and health. The presence of a grandfather, oddly, decreases it. I don't know why this is. Very little research has been done on this. Just slightly, but it does decrease. I don't know. Maybe that will change, because I do know my son's grandfathers are very actively involved in their, in his upbringing. Anyway, that's what the stats show. So there's a good survival, there's a mechanism there, an evolutionary mechanism for how longevity could have been pushed up. There is a wonderful story, in fact, that one of these researchers found many years ago. There was a nomadic tribe that was moved camp every time they wanted to get to new sources of food. And in this tribe, there was a mother and her child who were very, very sick and they couldn't walk. The grandmother, an elderly woman, picked up her daughter on her shoulders. She carried her on her back and she carried the baby in her arms and she walked hundreds of miles to catch up to the tribe. She guaranteed the survival, literally guaranteed the survival of her descendants by that one act. And again and again, anthropologists who have done research in this area, and particularly Kristen Hawkes at the University of Utah has done this work, showing just what powerhouses these women are. She calls them hard-working grandmothers. I mean, the community she studied are called the Hadza, a hunter-gatherer community, and she titled her paper Hard-Working Hadza Grandmothers. And, you know, think of your own lives. Think of the roles that your grandmothers have played in your lives or your children's lives. And you can see it play out in action. What fascinated me was that here was the patriarch hypothesis, which many men have worked on, actually almost exclusively men have worked on. Here was the grandmother hypothesis, which a man came up with it in the first place, but many women have worked on it since then. Now, if science were perfectly objective, we wouldn't have two theories with two genders behind both of them, would we? And that intrigued me, because what does that say about science? That must mean that bias is at play here. And everywhere I looked when I was doing my research, bias came in, you know? The way I've structured the chapters is I take high-profile, influential studies that claim to see very big sex differences or claim to reinforce a long-standing stereotype and ask, actually, is that true? Is that really the case, or is there something here? And again, there were flaws there somewhere. There was bias in the experiment or an agenda on the researcher's part, funding, lots of different things came in. What astounded me is that many of the male scientists, and many of them are kind of at the end of their careers now or already retired, so had these ideas in the 60s and 70s, were unwilling to even read criticisms of their research, critiques, papers that challenge their own papers, which is very unscientific. You know, science is supposed to be about humility. It's about saying, yes, I might be wrong, and I have to explore the possibility that I might be wrong and amend my theory as a result. The fact that they're not doing that to me is a problem for science. And one of the messages I want people to take away from Inferior is that read science critically. There is more going on here than just data and facts. There are people behind this. There are cultures and ideas and politics behind it. And that can influence the outcome of research as much as anything else.
I'm going to open up to the audience. I have totally hogged our time, so we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I want to give you the opportunity to ask a question. I'm going to go to the lady here who's right in the middle, just to make it extra hard for the people with the microphone.
Hi, thanks. I'm interested in what you said about the female immune system being more robust, and yet women make up 3/4 of the people who have autoimmune diseases,
yeah.
And there's very little research done into that. Mm-hmm. Do you think those two things are related, and is there research starting to happen now?
They are related. So autoimmune diseases are a result of having a flexible immune system, a stronger immune system. So an autoimmune disease is essentially a kind of exaggerated response to an immune attack, like arthritis. So of course, yes, these two things are related, and the research is being done into it. What is worrying is that we accept women's pain much more than we accept men's pain. And in fact, there was an article I wrote recently on the male pill. So there have been efforts recently to develop a male pill. The reasons they have been stalled is we do have, even though it's very difficult because it relies on hormones, and of course male hormones are very different from female hormones, and they're difficult to control in that way. But a pill was developed, it was clinically tested, and the men complained that it gave them side effects, the kind of side effects we get when we're on our period. And so they stopped development of it. Well, we put up with it. You know, we put up with the challenge of having to remember to take contraception, having to, you know, plan our lives around it, put up with the pain that we experience every month. Why can we not shift some of that pain onto men? Because the idea of men being in pain is such an anathema to us. But we accept that women are going to experience some pain in life. And I think we as women also feel that we should experience some pain in life. Well, no, we don't have to. It can be another way, and I think researchers are catching on to that.
Isn't one of the reasons given for monogamy that the fellows then wouldn't know who the fathers were?
Yeah, so this comes down to the question of, really the question of why men dominate patriarchy. This is at the heart of the question. And there has, I mean, I have an entire chapter on this, but I'll be very concise. One of the ideas about why men started to control women, started to control their sexual behaviour, was exactly this, that they wanted to be sure that their children were their own, that they didn't want to be cuckolded. And we see this kind of mate-guarding behaviour, as it's known in biology, in other species too. We see it in pigeons. And in fact, Robert Trivers, who did a lot of work on this, studied pigeons outside his bedroom window at Harvard, and he saw kind of lengths that the male pigeons would go to stop their female pigeons from straying, going off with other males. And he extended that to humans. You know, this is how humans behave. So there is some theory. The origins of patriarchy are a difficult thing. It is something I'm researching now, because we have very little understanding of how it, where it came from. We know it did start at some point. We weren't all, you know, humans weren't always patriarchal or male-dominated. The question is, how did this start, and how did it become so exaggerated to the point we have now? And one theory is that mate guarding was kind of lay at the roots of it.
Well, thank you for handing over the microphone. I was wondering, in what way do you think science education in, for example, university or high schools should be altered? Well, for example, experience from my own life, I'm a biomed student, mm-hmm. and did a little bit on neurobiology, and we were talking about how if you have, for example, a heart stroke, you can feel the pain somewhere else, and that's very different from male to females. Mm-hmm. And I asked a question about that to my professor, and he didn't even know about it. And that's, yeah. to be honest, really shocked me that even yeah. the person who's teaching me doesn't know about the difference between the male and the female body. So
yeah.
How do you think education itself should be altered?
It's funny, in some ways, sex difference research is one of the most popular areas of research at the moment. But in medicine, because, like I said, the default has been the male body for so long, the idea that there might be differences in how people present with symptoms, and of course, heart disease is one of the big ones, stroke, and men and women do present with different symptoms there. But I think people are becoming more aware of that. There are certainly campaigns I've seen across the world to make people aware of that. But I think more fundamentally, when it comes to education, we need to stop. One of the things that really bothers me is this idea that we have, that I saw at the March for Science last year. I was on the March for Science. I actually spoke at the March for Science in London. But what bothered me was this idea that we have to trust everything science says because these people are experts. Well, actually, science gets stuff wrong. Scientists are not always good people. And actually, we should know that because of eugenics, because of, you know, we've had plenty of evidence that they get things wrong. And the reason they get things wrong is because that's how science works. You make mistakes, then you learn, and you do it again, you learn a bit more. And especially when it comes to human behavior and human biology, we are so complicated. We're not going to get it right first time. We're going to have to learn about these complex things that we are, and that's going to take a really long time. The assumption that we can know ourselves, you know, that we'll somehow have enough data tomorrow to know exactly who we are is just foolhardy. So I think we need to have, it, at the school level, a really honest portrayal of science as an endeavor. This is a process, working towards the truth, but along the way, mistakes will be made. People will have their own certain agendas and biases. Sometimes we can go down an incorrect path for a really long time, for many years, before we realize that it was wrong and then try and find the correct one. And if we have that honest relationship, I think we'll all be better off for it. I think part of the suspicion that people have around science at the moment, and you know there's this rise of flat earthers and climate change deniers, and is because it's hard to reconcile the fact that you're told that scientists are experts and they're always right, then why are some scientists climate change deniers? How does that fit then? Well, the answer is that different data can give you different results at certain points in time, and sometimes they can contradict each other, and sometimes some sets of data will be proven to be wrong, but not yet. And if we had that honest relationship, then we could accommodate this kind of plurality of thinking without having to kind of fit in our heads these two diametrically opposed views, which is scientists are perfect and yet they get things wrong, so science can't be right.
Ladies and gentlemen, can you please put your hands together for Angela Kramer?